Okay, so let's take a moment to bring our minds to rest. In accordance with whatever level of teachings you have experienced. In particular, letting our attention descend, I guess, it's the best word I come up with, from our busy minds into the feeling of our bodies in this present moment, seated where we're seated, in whatever room we're in, what it feels like to be embodied in this moment of awareness, this present moment of awareness. And in that state of attention, alertness, and relaxation, we will do our prayers. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru for continents, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms. According to the different propensities of beings, please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. Now my teaching prayers, the four dharmas of Gampopa. Dadan san shantam shelo trisu drawers in jilap du sol. Chalam du drawers in jilap du sol. Am trupa sowers in jilap du sol. Trupa yeshe su charwers in jilap du sol. I pray for blessing. May my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing. May the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing. May the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing. May confusion arise as wisdom. And from the aspiration to excellent conduct, one of the many aspiration prayers we do in the Kagyu lineage. Lai ke dang lu dang nu jin ke trum da da mi ke nam dang dro kun ji dra ke ji tsam par tam che ke di da ki cha ten to. In the tongues of Nagas, Yakshas, gods, those of humans and of demons too, in the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And then the reminder for arousing bodhicitta, very important step in preparing for the teachings. First aspiration and then the action plan. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. So now we will do our meditation. And before we start, I just want to remind everybody again that when we do this meditation, and you can apply this to pretty much anything you do in the world, we can actually consciously think, how does this relate to the paramitas? Am I putting any paramita or all the paramitas into effect through this activity? You know, if we remember that when we're being generous, then it, you know, sort of expands the intention of it to be a paramita. And then we can also remember to apply wisdom to it. Like, you know, this is just a dream. It's an illusion. It's impermanent. There's no one really doing anything or having anything done for them, or nothing happening. So, as I said last week, When we do taking and sending, we could think, and there are other ways to think of it, I'm sure, but this is what came to my mind. And we practice the when we do Tonglen, we practice the generosity of taking on someone else's suffering and giving away everything good that we have. When we practice the paramita of skillful action or ethical conduct. Literally, you know, we're cultivating bodhicitta. That's the second kind of ethical conduct, and we are benefiting beings, at least in our aspirations. We're practicing patience by doing the practice, you know, whether we feel like it or not. Some practice is sometimes one of the hardships that is talked about in the patience chapter, which we'll get to soon. And also the patience of taking on suffering. That definitely is one of the kinds of patience, is to be patient with the hardships of practice and whatever sufferings you undergo. So that's how we practice patience when we do taking and sending. And then the perseverance of continuing to practice. And when I mentioned it last week, I really didn't draw out the aspect that it's enthusiastic, it's joyful. You know, it's not the paramita of perseverance if it's not joyful perseverance or enthusiastic perseverance. So, you know, we may have to fake it till we make it, but it's good to bring that to mind, that we do this in a joyful way. Our meditation speaks for itself. It's a kind of meditation, and then it becomes wisdom when we practice what Tim Olmsted calls the threefold purity, which I think is kind of a nice, helpful way perhaps to say the free of the three spheres, you know, free of conceptuality, basically. We do our taking and sending and all our meditation. So let's bring our minds to rest again, or touch in again with that restful state that we already cultivated. Just letting go of any other thoughts and concerns we might have, putting them off until later. And in this alert and relaxed state of mind, we bring to mind the four reminders, which, as we have learned, are the preliminaries to mind training practice, as well as the foundation of all of our Dharma practice. So first, remembering and appreciating how rare it is to have this opportunity in this lifetime to encounter the Dharma and to actually have the conditions for practicing it. So really feeling that appreciation in our hearts. And then remembering that it will come to an end through impermanence and eventually death. We don't know how long we have it, so that's why we have to carpe diem, take advantage of every moment that we have to practice, you know, formal or informal. We just always keep the Dharma in mind and engage in all of our activities in a dharmic way as much as we can. Third, the law of karma, cause and result, taught by the Buddha, that if we engage in positive actions, we will reap happiness and good conditions in the future. If we engage in negative actions that harm others, or even ourselves, I think, we will suffer in the future, you know, in this and future lives. It will affect like our next rebirth. And if we engage in Dharma study, contemplation, and practice, then that helps liberate us. And we can become very effective in our ability to actualize our aspiration bodhicitta. And then finally, you know, that last reminder to not get sucked into anything that's engaging about samsara, because it's a dead end, basically. We need always to aspire, as the, I think it's verse 10 in the 37 practices, we need always to aspire for complete liberation from samsara, which is the confused state of mind that causes suffering. So here the instructions say to bring the mind to rest, like further to rest, by counting, Guru Yoga comes first. So we bring to mind the Lama or the Buddha, whoever for us represents the highest degree of love and compassion and concern for others that we have experienced. Could be our teacher, it could be the Buddha, could be Gampopa. and visualize them on the crown of our head. If we can visualize, you can just think that they're there, but if you visualize it, it becomes more powerful. So visualizing them on a lotus and moon seat, floating above the crown of our head, radiating love, compassion, bodhicitta, and awakening. Feeling in our heart the aspiration to become like that, to attain that same level of love, compassion, bodhicitta, and awakening that they represent to us. Requesting with or without words the blessing from that teacher or from the Buddha, that we may attain the same level of realization. Receiving the blessing just through asking for it, just through focusing on the possibility. And really feeling that in our body, that we've received that blessing, that we too have the potential for that same level of love, compassion, bodhicitta, and awakening. And then the visualization either dissolves into light and merges with us, or we can visualize the teacher or the Buddha descending into our heart center, coming to rest there and always being with us, representing our own innate Buddha potential. So now we'll briefly go through all the steps of coming to rest in the nature of mind. First, letting go of the solidity of our attachment to our experience, internal or external, looking at all our experience as a dream. And then turning our attention to examine the nature of our own awareness, which is unborn, the mind that is looking at all our experience as a dream, seeing where that mind might be located, what characteristics it might have. And simply by asking the question, it directs us to look, it helps us look more directly at our own mind, drawing our attention away from sensory objects. And then whatever conclusions we've come to about the mind that helps us experience our experience in a less solid way, a more dreamlike way, we let go of that, let even the remedy release naturally, which leaves us in a non-conceptual state. And the instruction is to rest in the essence, the basis of everything. And as we do that, I'm just going to read the instruction from Zhang Gongkong Tro from Great Path of Awakening for this step. He says, this instruction presents the actual method for placing the mind in the nature of all phenomena, the natural state, which is the basis of everything, also known as our own Buddha nature. That's what we're resting in. Let go and rest. Follow no train of thought, but rest evenly in a state in which mind itself is clear and free of conceptuality. So as concepts arise, we simply recognize and choose not to engage with them or to disengage from them. Or as Trungpa Rinpoche puts it, home sweet home. And now within this, within this resting in our own Buddha nature, in the basis of everything, we practice taking and sending alternately, synchronizing with the breath. Everybody knows the drill, so we'll just do that. Bringing to mind individuals, bringing to mind all sentient beings, starting at whichever end is most comfortable. Breathing in the suffering of whoever we're visualizing, really taking it on ourselves, letting it dissolve in our heart center, freeing them from it, breathing out to them everything good that we have access to all of our happiness, health, well-being, material possessions, whatever it is that they need, giving it freely without attachment. Breathing in the suffering on each in-breath or every few in-breaths. Breathing out the happiness and so forth on every out-breath or every few out-breaths. Staying in touch with the essence of the one who is doing this practice, the one who is breathing in the suffering, the one who is breathing out the happiness, which is the same essence as the one whose suffering we're breathing in and to whom we're sending our happiness. Remembering that it's all like a dream. Remembering the threefold purity. No one is really taking on. No one is really receiving what's being sent. And there's no transaction happening in any solid sense. If we've been focusing on individuals, maybe turn our attention to some individuals that we don't feel close to, and even some we may feel harm us. See if we can breathe in their suffering and send out our happiness and healing fully and without attachment, without hopes and fears, patiently, continuously, always staying in touch with our true nature. And now making sure that our meditation includes the scope of all sentient beings in all the six realms, whatever suffering they may have, that we have the capacity to breathe it in and take it away from them. And the capacity to share and give away whatever good we have. And that through this process, we are all now completely free from suffering, completely filled with happiness and well-being, and completely awakened. And now letting go of all visualization and conceptuality, coming back to just open awareness or resting in the nature of mind. And now back to study and contemplation mode. Okay, does anybody have anything before we start on the teaching? Any questions, any comments, any insights? And for those of you who didn't get my email earlier today, Lama Jinzong had a doctor's appointment, which Kathy tells us came out well, because she's been having some trouble with her back, for anybody who doesn't know that, and she's been looking at possible surgery in the short term, and now it's kind of up in the air. The doctor gave her a better report than she expected. So anyway, she's not here this week, so we've traded, and I'll do patience and she'll do perseverance. So once again, the six paramitas are the action in action bodhicitta. We aspire to attain awakening, full awakening, in order to help all beings attain awakening. That's our bodhisattva aspiration, our bodhicitta. And through the six paramitas, we actually bring that to fruition over time. As Pema Chodron says, we have to respect where we are with it. We don't expect it to be a paramita yet or a perfection, but we just work with it. And that's the journey of getting to the other side. She said you spend a lot of time in the river. So, right. So we've done generosity. We've covered generosity, the three kinds of generosity. Everybody knows those, but just take a moment to bring them to mind. What are the three categories of generosity that it is our job as a bodhisattva to practice? Material generosity, support or freedom, freeing others from fear, giving fearlessness, and giving the Dharma. And so I'm bringing into it today, we're going to mostly work with Ringu Tulku. We're going to look at Ornament of Precious Liberation. But I also remembered, because I have a note to myself somewhere, that in the Dharma Path teachings on mandala, some of you will be familiar with this already. You may have forgotten the content, but anybody who's done Dharma Path level 4 mandala, Lamanor Lurimbaje teaches the six paramitas in that section, because the six paramitas are associated with mandala practice, especially, you know, generosity. Excuse me. So anyway, he gave a very nice teaching. It's a short teaching, but very nice teaching on the paramitas. And I just wanted to read what he said about the third kind of generosity right here. The third type of generosity is called giving the Dharma. And this includes explaining the Dharma to others if you are capable of doing so. So, of course, we have to recognize what we're capable of sharing, you know, what we have certainty about, what we feel very well grounded in. Very important to, well, you know, I'm not sure I always do that, but we do our best. So we don't worry too much about, like, errors. We do our best, but best to share what we feel like we know well. So explaining the Dharma to others if you are capable of doing so. So it is important to have the ability, based on having mastered study, contemplation, and meditation of the Dharma. Then one becomes capable of explaining it to others. So the extent to which we have practiced study, contemplation, and meditation, then we can share like the results of that, our understanding of that. And he says also, and I think this is really important to keep in mind, explaining the Dharma without pride or regard for gain or service. I'm not sure what service means here, but maybe it's, you know, having people respect you in some way. Explaining that without pride or regard for gain or service in a way that will definitely benefit others, either temporarily or ultimately, that is what we do. So that's also important. We're benefiting people not only ultimately, which is helping them to attain full awakening, but whatever we can do for them that will improve their situation in this moment. So that is the third kind of generosity. So we've also covered the second paramita of ethical conduct or skillful action, and that also has three categories. So let's take a moment to review those in our mind. And if you don't have them, like, accessible, then that's a really good goal to have, to be able to remember all the categories of each paramita. So for ethics or skillful action, the first kind is avoiding harm to others, avoiding every kind of harm to others insofar as we're able. The second is cultivating our own bodhicitta, our own wisdom and compassion, through our own practice, our own study, contemplation, and meditation, doing that as much as possible. And the third is actually benefiting others in whatever ways we can, again, to help them in the moment or to help them, especially to help them wake up, attain awakening. So what Lamanor Lurimbaje had to say about that is, this is his summary of the the Paramita of Ethical Conduct. He says there are people who think that in practicing Dharma, that it's enough just to kind of be absorbed. This is the translator putting in the kind of, that it's enough to be absorbed in working on your own mind and eliminating personal defects or something like that, mistakes and defects, like to work on your own mind, cultivate your own wisdom, and just being careful not to do anything harmful or be careful with your own conduct. But we have to go beyond that. We have to do that. That's really important. But we also need to go beyond that to work to benefit others. So very important aspect of ethics is to do whatever we can to benefit others, to help others in whatever ways we can. There was something else I was going to say, but I seem to have forgotten it. All right. So now we are on to patience. And we're going to start with Ringu Tulku. Ringu Tulku is this section of the book, the third paramita. It's really, really good summary. Gampopa is pretty dense. You know, it's very lovely. It's like, you know, it's been my go-to guide for interpersonal relations for many years now. But it is, there's a lot of information in it. And Ringu Tulku does a lovely job of sort of summarizing it and really getting all of it in there. Although it's worth reading Gampopa as well, because there are some details and some ways that it's expressed that are also very helpful. But Ringu Tulku is great on this one. So we're on page 88 of Path to Buddhahood. And he calls the third paramita forbearance, as does Ken Holmes, and that's fine. It's to me, it's a near synonym. It's not 100% synonym. And as I understand forbearance, it almost bridges patience with perseverance. But we can just use whatever word we prefer, and I'm going to use patience. So he explains the Tibetan word zopa, that's the Tibetan word for patience or forbearance, means forbearance, patience, and tolerance. Patience is considered one of the most important paramitas since it is the antidote to one of the most common categories of mind poison, anger and hatred. Even if we have been practicing generosity and discipline for a long time, a fit of violent anger or hatred can considerably affect our accumulation of good actions. And we'll hear more about that from Gampopa when we get there, to the point of destroying all their merit. So that's worth considering. It's something that's repeated in the, you know, the classical texts again and again, that like one moment of giving in to anger can destroy eons of merit. And sort of vice versa, that like one moment of resting in the nature of mind can destroy eons of negative karma. So we do have an antidote. But the patience chapter is about learning not to give in to anger in various ways at various levels. So according, we're on page 89, according to the Buddha, nothing is worse than hatred and nothing is stronger or better than patience. This is why patience is such an important practice on the Bodhisattva path. There are three kinds of patience. We're going to see there's three kinds of everything. Three kinds of patience. The first consists in not returning evil for evil when confronted with people who do us wrong. We're going to read a little bit more in detail about that in Gampopa. But being patient with people who harm us in some way or people who push our buttons in some way. That's the first kind of patience. The second kind of patience is patience in the face of setbacks and difficult circumstances in life, particularly with regard to our Dharma practice, obstacles to Dharma practice, hardships in Dharma practice. The third kind of patience is the courage to face and accept the profound teachings on emptiness, the openness or broad-minded attitude necessary to make the effort to understand them, and the patience of not rejecting them if we don't understand them at first. We're going to read more on that from Lamanarla Rinpoche, which is actually the reason that I'm bringing his mandala teaching into this, because he explains this in a way that I think is really helpful. So with regard to the first kind, how can we develop sufficient patience not to hate or even, I would say, to be angry at someone who mistreats us? We must change our attitude. We all know that, right? In our culture, we know that too. You can't change somebody else's behavior. You can only change your response to it or how you relate to it. So we must change our attitude. As bodhisattvas, the onus is on us. When we reason and analyze the situation, different arguments can help us do this. And this is the strength of this chapter, is so many techniques for dealing with things that push your buttons, people who push your buttons, and things that push your buttons. So the first argument is that such people, someone who is pushing your buttons, someone who's doing something that harms you or makes you very angry, they have probably lost control over themselves. Various causes and circumstances probably give them the impression that they have to act as they do, meaning they have their own reason. To them, their behavior makes sense, whether it's like reasoned out or whether they're just overwhelmed by an emotion and they're acting out towards you based on something that maybe has nothing to do with you. They're under the influence of something that they are not able to not act out. So someone under the influence of anger or hatred is very much like someone under the influence of alcohol. We don't pay too much attention to what a drunk person says or does. Likewise, we shouldn't react strongly to an angry person's words or actions. So the pith of this is that when someone is acting in an angry way towards us or acting in a way that harms us, we can think that they're under the influence of their own emotionality. They're under the influence of a negativity. They're not in their right mind. They're under the influence of their own confusion. And quite often, when someone is harming us in some way or very angry with us, we can see like they don't normally act like that. Like there's something going on here with them. And so Gampopa and Ringu Tulku advise us to just disregard it. Just give them that benefit of the doubt that if they understood the result of what they were doing, if they really saw the situation clearly, then they wouldn't act that way. And they're acting that way because they have no control over their actions in this moment. And I just want to say that bringing these things to mind really helps. It helps to have a list of these somewhere where you can put your fingers on it, like when you need it. Like somebody does something to you and you do that counting to 10 thing. You just take a moment. You don't react right away and you can go through the list mentally. They're under the influence of, you know, some emotion. So let's disregard the emotion and just wait for this to pass. Second one, also very helpful. Let's see, the first argument. Okay. He's not going right to it. So to continue with Ringu Tulku, page 89, besides, as mental phenomena, anger and compassion are interrelated. Buddhism classes these two emotions in the same category. When we are faced with a disagreeable experience, two emotional reactions are possible, either anger or compassion. When someone irritates us, we react with anger. That's our habitual reaction. However, if we relate directly to the cause of our irritation, which is the disagreeable impression experienced and associated with it, meaning that it's causing us to suffer, then we'll start feeling compassion instead. Oh no, I guess this is thinking of their suffering, thinking of like their own discomfort that's causing them to act like this. Then we'll feel compassion if we look at that, because we come to understand that the person who's making us suffer didn't really mean to do so. Logically, what motivates someone to harm us is his or her ignorance, suffering, fears, and anxieties. And I find this very helpful to just think of how much the other person is suffering, that they're acting like this, that they're feeling like this, that they're harming us comes out of their own suffering. And that helps to turn it around towards the compassion end of things. Without such causes, their own ignorance, suffering, fears, and anxieties, the person wouldn't have any reason to try to harm us. Instead of blaming the person, let's blame the negative emotions, the malaise, the confusion, and the suffering that are the real causes of his or her behavior. Let's rather be angry at the anger than at the person who's only its vehicle. From this perspective, we have many more reasons to feel compassion than to react with hatred or anger toward those who irritate or attack us. So is that one clear to everybody? That's all part of the first one, is just look at the other person's situation. They're under the influence. They have lost control of themselves. It's their suffering. It's their own suffering or their own ignorance that is causing them to act this way. So here's the second one, which is the second place our mind can go when we're under attack. We find a second reason for not reacting with anger when we consider the karmic mechanism involved in any particular situation. If we understand the law of karma, we can better accept negative circumstances arising in our lives, even when they are quite painful, because we understand that what happens to us is the result of similar actions we did in a previous life. And if you think back to the karma chapter, or you were to go back and review the karma chapter, there's a lot of information there about what kinds of actions lead to what kind of karmic payback. So we think in one of our past lives, we must have harmed that person who now causes us problems or wishes us ill. Our suffering is the result of our own karma. Why then get angry at someone if he or she is only the instrument of our own karma? If we react with anger, we only accumulate more bad karma. So there's a reason right there. That's a self-interest reason to not react in kind. Not only are they accumulating bad karma through maltreating you, but then you're accumulating bad karma by reacting in a negative way that harms them in return. So on the other hand, if we cultivate patience, our negative karma dissolves. It's therefore much wiser not to get angry. Patience helps everyone involved and transforms our negative karma into positive karma. So that's another really powerful reason. So first one, they're not in control of themselves. They're suffering. So we can respond with empathy and compassion. Second one, it's karma. Like, I must have done something to deserve this. If not in this lifetime, then in some previous lifetime. And we don't have to worry about whether it's true or not. It's actually a thing that helps us in the moment to feel better, to not get carried away. It helps keep us from incurring a negative result ourselves. And I tell this story every time every time I teach this, of my retreat mate, Lama Dachen, at the monastery. We were next door neighbors in our 3-year retreat. And that was her go-to thing. And I don't even know if she'd read Gumpopa. I think probably she hadn't. But she knew her reflex was karma. So anytime anybody did anything that, she might have gotten angry about, and maybe she did get angry, but she would always say, I must have done something, I must have done the same thing to somebody in a previous life, or I must have done the same thing to them, at some point. This is for our own, it's not an intellectual exercise, is this true or not? What could I have possibly done? It's a way of relieving the pressure in the moment. Oh, they're not in control. Oh, my own karma is at least a factor in this. It takes the blame out of it a little bit. It helps us to simmer down our emotional reaction. So it's about our own comfort in a certain way, our own comfort and our own well-being. It's not necessarily letting the other person off the hook, but it's not escalating the situation, which is always where we want to be. As Pema Chodron often says, we want to learn how to de-escalate and stop escalating situations. That is the path of a bodhisattva. So the third argument, and there are a lot in Gumpopa, there's about 9, I think. He's only going to go over some of them, and he's leaving out some of the ones that I think are a little bit hard to relate to. If you read it, there are a couple that are kind of head scratchers that I think are more like Tibetan style of thinking than Western style of thinking. But his third argument sort of encompasses some of those, the third argument that Ringu Tulku gives us. So the third argument for not reacting with anger is that the drawbacks of a situation aren't just attributable to the person who seems to be the cause. It's not just that person being angry at us. Suppose someone throws a stone at us. Why get angry with the person who throws the stone and not with the stone? It's the stone that hurt us, right? We could just as well get angry with our own mind and body. And this is one of Gumpopa's things. It's like, my body is to blame, because if I didn't have a body, then this thing wouldn't hurt me, or this thing wouldn't bother me. So we could just as well get angry with our own mind and body, because they're part of the equation. So this is about interdependence. This is a lovely expression of interdependence. That helps us to not focus on any one aspect and place blame there and get angry there. So we could, rather than just be angry at the person, we could be angry at the stone or, you know, whatever it is. We could be angry at our own body. Like we could be angry at everything that has, every cause and condition that has brought about this situation. Rengu Tulku says, indeed, without body and mind, we would feel no suffering. All of these elements combine to make us experience suffering. It's like a whole ball of wax, not just one. It's not just that the person's yelling at us or whatever they're doing. There's a lot of elements to the situation. So all of these elements combine to make us experience suffering, our mind, our body, the stone, and the person who threw it, as well as that person's anger and anguish. So why get angry only at the last one? Okay, so now there's another one from Gompopa. These are very powerful. A fourth reason not to give in to anger is to understand that far from harming us, that person is actually helping us. So if you remember, I'm just going to pull out my 37 practices here. I think I better, I'm just going to read because I forgot what verse I was looking up. The aging brain. He or she is giving us the opportunity to practice patience and therefore to purify our negative karma, right? I was actually going to read the paramita, the paramita of patience, because it's exactly what it says. So that is verse 27. For bodhisattvas wishing to accrue a wealth of wholesome virtue and good deeds. So you want to accumulate merit on the path to awakening because you need merit on the path to awakening. All harm is like a precious treasure trove from other people or adversity. To cultivate a patient attitude, not feeling irritated or abused, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So you look at this situation where you're being harmed by someone as a rare opportunity to cultivate patience. Let's see how Rengu Tulku says it. So he or she is giving us the opportunity to practice patience and therefore to purify our negative karma. This gradual purification will in the end allow us to attain enlightenment. The apparent ill will of that person, in fact, gives us a precious opportunity to train. And instead of resenting that person, we should, on the contrary, be grateful. So that's a stretch. That one's really a stretch. It's a little easier to remember under the influence of negativity, under the influence of their own suffering. My own karma is part of it. Interdependence. It's a little harder to go, oh, thank you for, you know, this miserable situation I'm in right now because it's going to help me awaken. If I can practice it, if I can remember the Dharma and apply the Dharma here, it's really going to help me wake up. And if nobody ever harmed me, I would never have a chance. I wouldn't be able to wake up because you have to cultivate patience as part of the path of awakening. So we're going to skip the story on page 91. And go to the bottom of page 91. Yet another argument for not reacting with anger has us examine why we react with anger. There's another one that's not so easy to do. What exactly are we looking for? Do we wish to make the other person unhappy, to make them suffer? If this is the case, what would be the worst we could do to them? Kill them? If this is what we're after, all we are doing is advancing the hour of their death a little. They'll have to die one day anyway. When we kill someone, we bear the bad karma associated with this act. If we don't kill them, they will die of their own accord. With patience, we are the winners. So, you know, if our anger at them were so extreme that we killed them, we would accumulate terrible karma and they were going to die anyway. So it doesn't really change anything. Furthermore, if we want them to suffer in their turn, have no doubt they will. So they are creating negative karma by hurting us. That is its own punishment in the end. And as bodhisattvas, we're not really allowed to like rejoice in that. We're supposed to feel compassion for their suffering. But that is a thing we can do in the moment, is feel compassion for the person who's harming us, or the person who's harming anyone, the person who's causing a war. You know, whatever it is, the person who's causing people to be evicted, poor people to be evicted from their homes, like whatever the thing is, it's really helpful to recognize that they are accumulating negative karma that's going to hurt them in the long run. It's going to cause them suffering in the long run. And again, we don't rejoice in it, but it elicits our compassion. So that person is the one who will have to bear all the bad karma associated with their action. Even now, the hatred or the anger they feel throws them into a state of discomfort. So it's not fun to be angry. It's not fun to be hurting someone. So if we can remember that, they're not only the suffering that's causing them to act that way, but the suffering that they're actually feeling in this moment of doing harm to you or to someone else. It takes the blame out of it. It simmers down our emotional reaction to it. So hatred and anger burn you inside and bring you great suffering. Patience is thus a much wiser method. So then, you know, I'm not sure he's taking this step here, but what I get from this, and I also get this from Gampopa, is when we react with anger, it also harms us. That's suffering for us. That's not a good feeling. And it has health impact, has impact on our health, raises our blood pressure and so forth, causes us stress, causes cortisol to emanate from wherever cortisol emanates from, the adrenal glands or whatever. There's all kinds of physical harm that happen when you are in an angry state. So patience, as Rinku Tulku says, is thus a much wiser method. So if we could just remember, if you just remember one in any given situation, it will really help. And I tell you that from years of personal experience. So page 92, when we examine the main cause of anger and hatred, feeling hurt or threatened by someone, we see that harboring anger until it becomes hatred does not ease the hurt. Holding a grudge, holding on to hatred also hurts. So it's better to forgive. So it's adding like suffering upon suffering. You have the suffering of whatever the person did to you, and then you have the suffering of blaming them for it, being angry at them for it, and holding a grudge for it, never forgetting it. So Rinku Tulku sums up here, these are some of the numerous arguments that can help us to subdue anger and adopt a patient attitude. And again, if you want the full list, go to Gampopa, the three kinds of patient, where he explains each of the three aspects in detail. And I think there's 9 different methods, and you could have at least three or four of them like at the top of your head all the time. So an advanced bodhisattva no longer needs such logical reasoning, since he or she is naturally free from anger. But for those of us who are still subject to impatience, irritation, anger, and hatred, it is good to recall regularly all the good reasons we have to be forbearing or patient. So again, I recommend making a list. Like, you know, just say, not in control of themselves. They are suffering too. Wrecking their karma. Cause, you know, one factor is my karma, and so on and so forth. And so have it somewhere you can glance at it when you're tempted to react with anger. So that's the first kind of patience. And most of Gampopa's chapter is about that, because that's probably what we deal with the most. And it's also probably the most harmful, because it involves another person. Like, it involves us, you know, retaliating and then harming in return another person. So that's the most serious kind of lack of patience. So anybody have any questions or comments on the first kind of patience? Marilyn, I'm going to put my notes aside so I can unmute you. Oops. Okay, you are finally unmuted.
Well, a lot of what works for me is burning up. This person is helping me burn up negative karma. It isn't necessarily in that one, because it also could be in the next, in the second kind of patience, which is, you know, that unfortunately it works better when it's something like big, like I've really hurt myself. And if that kind of burning up negative karma doesn't seem to arise when I'm getting in an argument with somebody. So it works for the bigger things, but not so much the smaller things. But it seems to me it's involved in just about everything we're talking about.
That it's burning off karma, like whatever's making you suffer is burning off karma.
Yeah.
Yeah, And that's a good way to put it. That's a really good sort of pithy way to put it. We're burning off karma by tolerating it, by being patient with it. And we're not burning off karma if it causes us to react in kind emotionally. We're accumulating more negative karma. Anybody else? Then we will go on to the second kind of patience. And again, it's in the 37 practices verse, which I'm going to read one more time. So for bodhisattvas wishing to accrue a wealth of wholesome virtue and good deeds, for those of us who want to travel the bodhisattva path, all harm is like a precious treasure trove from other people or adversity. So now we've done the other people part. Now we're going to do the adversity part. We have to be patient with circumstances as well. So Rinpoche Tulku says on page 92, the second kind of patience is the one we develop to confront the difficult circumstances of life. When we set out on a spiritual path, it's probable that we'll encounter many obstacles. Anybody not encountered obstacles since they started practicing the Dharma? If we're seriously ill, so this is not to do with this. This is like an analogy. If we're seriously ill, we agree to undergo an operation or a painful treatment because we understand that it's a lesser evil that enables us to avoid a greater one. We do the chemotherapy. You know, we do the radiation. We get the surgery, whatever it is, because we know that the suffering is going to be worse than the suffering that we're incurring. So Rinpoche Tulku says we must show the same patience, the same confidence to endure the difficulties we encounter on our path when we want to heal the sufferings of samsara. Let's behave like valiant warriors. Someone who's capable of confronting a great danger or a ferocious enemy is considered brave and courageous. But by committing ourselves to the Dharma, we're actually engaging in a battle with our worst and most powerful enemies, our negative emotions. That's another verse in the 37 practices. We have to tame our own inner anger in order to keep the armies of angry ones from harming us. By committing ourselves to the Dharma, we're actually engaging in a battle with our worst and most powerful enemies, our negative emotions, which have caused us so much suffering and have kept us in the grasp of their tyranny from time immemorial until today. If we manage to crush such enemies, we'll become victors forever. Such an endeavor demands that we be ready for every challenge and every difficulty. So really the hardest battle is against your own inner demons, your own habitual reactions. It may not be a battle that's visible to others, but it's very hard. And that's why Trungpa Rinpoche often talked about the bodhisattva as the spiritual warrior. So that's the second kind. I'm going to read... Oh, no, I'll save that. Okay. So the third kind of patience consists in persevering with our studies, listening and learning until we understand the truth. To understand profound teachings demands patience. Remember the first time you heard about the three kayas? I know that's Marilyn's favorite. What? Like, do I really have to understand? This doesn't make any sense to me. There's no point in going on because I'm never going to get it. Emptiness. Like, we're still working on what emptiness means, right? So you have to have the patience to, like, not understand, but to keep going. To understand profound teachings demands patience. We should be confident that we will understand later what we don't understand now and persevere in our efforts. That's the next paramita. To thoroughly understand the deepest aspects of the Buddhist philosophy is something so great, so extraordinary, that we must not expect to achieve it all at once. We must be patient, work harder, show greater interest, and persevere in our meditation. And little by little, this understanding will develop. Let's not be impatient. Let's not be discouraged. Let's not close our mind thinking that we will never understand the philosophy of emptiness. Absolute bodhicitta, the Dharmakaya, emptiness, ultimate truth, are all difficult notions to grasp. In fact, they're beyond grasp. You can't grasp them conceptually. And that's what makes them so hard and so frustrating, is that we're used to solving things with our analytical abilities. I mean, that's our whole life training. And we encounter these concepts, or these, you know, these concepts, we'll call them concepts, that we can't. We can't unpack them. We have to sort of persevere with them until we can go beyond engaging with them conceptually. It's very frustrating when, you know, when you're so used to solving problems with your, you know, your mind, your analytical powers. So these are difficult notions to grasp. In fact, they're beyond grasp. And that's indeed why they're so difficult to understand for our minds that are accustomed to concepts. If we can't manage to classify something in one or another category, we simply can't understand it. Since ultimate nature is beyond all categories and concepts, there's in a way nothing to understand. As long as we still hope to understand something that we can hold and put neatly in one of the drawers of our mind, we haven't understood the teachings yet. We need a lot of patience to develop a very broad mind, which will give us access to this level of understanding. You just have to keep plugging at it. So that's, you know, this patience plus joyful perseverance. So we have about a half hour left. Anybody have any questions or comments at this point before we briefly look at Gampopa? Okay, so we're going to go on to Gampopa. We're just going to hit a couple of highlights here that I just want to, Rinku Tulku basically covered everything, but I just want to point out like how Gampopa expressed a couple of things. So first, he begins as always with the seven topics, and same seven topics. This is on page 181 of OPL. So it's the same seven topics for all the paramitas. The wisdom paramita has a slightly different configuration. It's almost the same, just slightly different, but it's identical for the first five paramitas. I'm not going to read through the topics, but you can familiarize yourself with them. The first one, though, is the drawbacks of not having patience and the benefits of practicing patience. And there were some interesting things in this, I thought. So he says on page 181, if someone possesses, oh yes, this is the thing. This is the thing he says at the beginning of every chapter. If someone possesses generosity and moral discipline, yet lacks patience, anger can still arise. So we're not going to become enlightened. So it's great that we've done patience. It's great that we've done generosity. It's great that we've worked on ethical conduct. You could perfect them, but you still need patience to become enlightened, to really wake up. So that's the first one, is that you can't get there. And in particular here, it's not said that way until later in the chapter. He says anger can still arise. Anger is really the enemy of Dharma practice. It's the most the coarsest enemy, or the least subtle enemy. But he says, once anger has arisen, all the virtue created up to that time through generosity, moral discipline, and so forth can be consumed right there and then. So great that we have, you know, worked on generosity, great that we've worked on ethical conduct, but a moment of anger can destroy all of that. So that's why we need patience. Then on the next page, 182, he talks about how unpleasant anger is. Bottom of page 181, really. So if you feel anger, the mind thus afflicted knows no joy, no peace, and in the end, the person cannot even find rest in sleep. Is that what anger feels like? Like, how many times have we lain awake at night or woken up at 3 a.m, like going over and over again some way someone has harmed us? The point here is that anger is extremely uncomfortable for us. He quotes Shantideva, in brief, through their anger, those in good circumstances find no joy. So no matter how good your life is, how much money you have, what a great job, what great relationships, you know, how many material possessions you have, if you're angry, you can't enjoy them at all. Okay, so then this is another argument, another drawback of anger. So he's convincing us why the immediate gratification of anger is really not worth it. So the third reason is the anger dwelling within someone who lacks patience will also show on the outside as a violent demeanor. Through this, friends, relatives, and employees all become fed up with the angry person. Even gifts of money or valuables cannot persuade them to put up with his or her presence any longer. So if you're an angry person, people don't want to be around you, basically. You know, or maybe you're not like always angry and people don't always avoid you, but you're angry right now and basically everybody's looking for a way out of the room. So that's the third reason that it's good to develop patience. Right. And then so further down page 182, furthermore, those lacking patience lay themselves open to harmful forces or maras, which then create obstacles for them. So anger opens the door to demons, like to just negative influences, to other negative influences in our minds, to like our darker side kind of taking over. What else we got? Okay, and then the zinger is where there is anger and no patience, how can there be enlightenment? So we won't wake up. If we don't have patience, we can't become Buddhas. So what are the advantages of anger? I mean, the advantages of patience. Page 183, all sorts of happiness and well-being are found in everyday circumstances if we're patient, as opposed to if we're angry. And if you possess patience, you will attain the unsurpassed enlightenment. You will wake up with patience. So then the other thing I wanted to point out, because we're not going to do the whole chapter, but is the definition. I always like to look at the definition and commit the definition to memory if possible. And the definition or nature of patience, page 183, middle of the page, is it's a very high bar. So the definition of patience is to be unperturbed by anything. So obviously that's the perfection of patience. Did you have something to say, Marilyn? Yes, I'm going to unmute you. You are unmuted.
I can't help it. I do love imperturbability.
Yes.
But I noticed that the footnote says to be able to cope with anything.
Yes, yes. I have a note about that. Yes, he says if he were to translate it less literally, it just means we could cope with anything that arises. So that's helpful. But I also like that high bar. Oh, Mark has his hand up too. Anything else, Marilyn? Okay. Mark, I'm going to unmute you.
Okay. I always listen to Trungpa's commentary on the jewel ornament. For these, and you didn't cover this, but he says that patience takes you out of the moment, you know, and so you listen to something about enlightenment and the benefits of being completely clear and free and everything, and then you are impatient with your present state of mind, and so that ruins your ability to work in the moment with your present state of mind. And that's really the only thing that you can actually work with.
Right.
Present state of mind. So it destroys your ability to actually move towards actually getting where you want to get to.
Right. That would be the mechanism, I guess. That's really helpful. So impatience or anger, that takes you out of the present moment.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
It ruins your opportunity to work on where you are.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for sharing that. Anne, you have something?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that jewel ornament has a nice definition also. It says definition of patience is a feeling of ease.
Right.
With some other quality to add to.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always found that a little harder to relate to than saying it the other way around. But yeah, it's like if you're patient and it's like you're unruffled. Like if you're not easily ruffled, it's a feeling of ease. It is very lovely. So it's worth looking at the different translations if you happen to have them, because sometimes you get like an insight from one way that it's translated that that you maybe didn't get from the other. Okay, thanks, Anne. Anybody else? Steve, you're unmuted.
Thank you. It's not referred to in either of the texts, but it seems to me that the lack of patience equates to ego clinging.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And wondered why that's not sort of explicit. It's sort of the underpinning of all this. Do I have that right?
You do. Absolutely do. I think he doesn't point it out for every paramita, and I'm not sure where in the book it talks about it, or if he does talk about it in exactly those terms. But the way that it works is what causes us to suffer. Like if you look at the teachings on karma, I think it's in the teachings of karma that this is usually explained, and maybe in the karma chapter of this. So the immediate cause of our suffering is harmful actions, right? Like we do something, we say something, or we engage in a physical action that hurts someone. So that's going to cause us suffering. And but where does that come from? The harmful action comes from the negative emotion, which in this case, lack of patience, anger. And where does the negative emotion come from? All the emotional poisons come from ego clinging. From me first, the opposite of mind training. So it's in there, but it's not stated, you know, per se in each of the paramitas. So I appreciate you bringing that forward because that's absolutely true. And that's a very good sequence to always keep in mind. Like it's ignorance or ego clinging that's the cause of everything, you know, cause of everything negative, because it leads to the six emotional poisons, and the six emotional poisons then lead us into actions of body, speech, or mind that cause the actual harm, cause the actual negative karma. Okay, anything else, Steve?
That's it, thanks.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else have an insight to enrich the class? All right, then we will... So that was the definition, is to be unperturbed by anything, or to have a feeling of ease in all situations. To be able to cope with anything is like, that would be a sense of ease, right? If you just knew, because you had cultivated patience, that it would take you through any kind of situation that could arise. You'd be able to practice patience in any situation. You would never need to worry. You would never need to be concerned about it, because you can, you know, you can just get through whatever arises in your life. So we know the three aspects. I don't need to go over those again. We're going to actually look at those one more time with Lamanorla Rinpoche's short teaching. But on page 184, where he's talking, he's given us the three aspects. That's the third topic. And then the fourth topic is to explain the characteristics of each aspect. And so the first one, where you're patience with other people harming you, is a few pages in the book, and that's where you have the list of nine and the list of five, all these lists of different tools you could have in your toolbox. But he gives us a really helpful piece of information in this section, and it's on page 184, the end of the first paragraph. What does it mean to be patient in such circumstances when someone is harming you? Patience means remaining unperturbed. That's like ultimate, not retaliating in kind, and not holding on to the other one's mind. So I think that those are three different frontiers we could work on. Like the imperturbability is going to be the last one that we get. But in the meantime, we can at least not retaliate, you know, at least hold back from retaliating, even if our mind is perturbed. And we can also not hold a grudge. Like that could take some work, but we could not hold on to the thing. We could let it go. So those are the three ways to practice patience with people, is to not let it bother you. If that fails, don't retaliate. And whether that fails or not, don't hold on to it. So I think that's another really handy list to have, like always available. So then he goes through the nine different kind of ways you can think about it when people are harming you. And then we have another list that I think is really helpful that's not in Ringu Tulku, and it's on page 186. So after he's given us all the ways, because we're still in the first aspect, the first type of patience, he's given us all the different nine ways that we can think about it. They're not in control of themselves. It's my karma. It's interdependence. This is actually helping me wake up, having to deal with somebody harming me, and so forth. So he then gives us at the bottom of page 186, and this is from Asanga's text, Bodhisattva Levels. Bodhisattva Levels teaches us to cultivate patience on the basis of developing five recognitions. So there's another set of ways to look at the situation, and I think it's really helpful. So first, recognize the harmer as someone dear to your heart. So this is we're talking a culture here where people, like, reincarnation is just in people's faces. They're always thinking, oh, this person has been my mother before. This person has been my teacher before. This person has been, like, my pet before, my beloved pet. So it helps to remember that they've been in a different relationship to you in a different lifetime. Like, this person that you're so angry at, what if they were your best friend, you know, in your last lifetime, or your best friend who died a few years ago and they're back? So recognize them as someone who has been dear to you at some point. Second, this one's very profound. Recognizing the harmer as a mere phenomenal reality means that the harm that is taking place is dependent on conditions. As such, it is no more than mere notions, mere phenomena. Look at all experience as a dream is what this one is. It's like it's really just a dream. There is not even the slightest trace, and this takes us to something, to the wisdom aspect. There's not even the slightest trace of an instigator, the person who's harming you, a life, or a sentient being who is being abusive or who can strike you, defame you, or obstruct your activities. So remembering emptiness, remembering the dreamlike nature of all our experience. So practice patience through thinking like this. Third, recognizing the harmer as impermanent means to contemplate this. Sentient beings are impermanent. They are mortal, and the greatest harm that can befall them is to lose their lives. Thus, you can practice patience by contemplating that there is no need to kill them since they will die anyway due to the very nature of their existence. And that's also in the nine. So this one's in both groups, in both sets. Fourth, recognize, so there is some overlap. This one also overlaps. Recognizing the harmer's suffering. Every sentient being is afflicted by the three types of suffering. Think that you should be removing sufferings and not creating further ones. So this is actually takes us a little deeper than just remembering that they're suffering or remembering that we're going to cause ourselves suffering by reacting in kind. It's like, we're bodhisattvas. Remember that you're a bodhisattva. Remember that your job is to decrease the suffering of others and not to increase it. So don't do things that cause other people to suffer, even if they've done something to cause you to suffer. And this is practicing patience by seeing suffering. And then the fifth and final one, recognizing the harmer as someone to be utterly cared for. Oh, well, so these two are very similar, the last two. Means thinking, since I have taken the bodhisattva vow, I should be working for the welfare of all sentient beings. Bearing this in mind, hold every sentient being very dear to your heart with a fondness like you have for your own spouse, assuming you have a good marriage and, you know, treasure your spouse. Give rise to patience by seeing that it is not fitting to retaliate for trivial harms done by someone that you treasure so deeply. So that's all we're going to look at in Gampopa. But just to point out, though, the last three topics on pages 188 to 189 are always the same for all of the paramitas: how the paramita can be increased, how it can be made pure, and what are the results or the benefits of it. So those are very similar. They vary in some specifics, but those are very similar in all of the paramitas. If you know them for one paramita, then you know them for all of them. In particular, how it can be made pure. Means that you practice patience that is supported by emptiness, which is wisdom and compassion. Just remembering your Buddha nature, remembering emptiness and compassion in all of your practice of patience. Not just doing it as an isolated, you know, instance of being patient, but putting it in the context of the path of awakening. Oh, I've got the wrong thing. So now, I'm going to, did anybody got anything before I read you Lama Narla Rinpoche's short comments from the Dharma Path Mandala section on this? Okay, so let's see. So we've done that one. So I'm going to just read you what he says about patience. So the third paramita is patience, and there are three kinds of patience to meditate on. The first, and this is a review, the first is the patient that thinks nothing of harm, that like ignores someone who's harming you, that isn't bothered by harm. That is the patience to bear with indifference harm that is inflicted by others, such as verbal abuse, beating, striking, robbery, or defeat. Whatever anybody does to you, you're not bothered by it. That's the first kind of patience. Or at least if you're bothered, you don't retaliate and you don't hold on to it. The second kind of patience is that is the patience that willingly accepts suffering. This has to do with the context, especially when we're practicing Dharma. This is voluntarily accepting suffering when practicing Dharma without regard for illness, hunger, thirst, depression, fatigue, or the absence of supportive conditions. The last one, for example, so he talks about the example of 3-year retreat. Excuse me, I got a cough again. So when one is in 3-year retreat, one has very good supportive conditions for practicing Dharma. But when you come out, you may feel that you've lost those supportive conditions and think, how can I practice? Well, that puts us right in with everybody else, right, who didn't get to do 3-year retreat. Like all the people whose lives are very busy with, you know, responsibilities, jobs, and responsibilities to others and families and so forth. So when you think, oh, how can I practice? I don't have any supportive conditions for practice. Rinpoche says that is actually a form of patience, to be patient with the absence of supportive conditions and still keep practicing the Dharma. Right, to find ways to practice the Dharma, even if you don't have conditions that are conducive to it. And so that's one of the places where sometimes we have to focus on practice in daily life. If we can't get to the cushion or the chair very often to do formal practice, then we remember the Dharma in our, you know, we continue to focus on the Dharma. We don't get carried away with like worrying about what we don't have, but we just practice with whatever we have. So he says, there definitely will be times when you're struggling or feeling that conditions aren't good. And it's very important to remember that it really doesn't matter whether happiness or suffering arises in your mind, or whether conditions are good or bad, or whether you have all the right conditions or not, because it's ultimately all just the appearance of mind. So remembering emptiness again, remembering the nature of mind again, will help us to be patient with circumstances. He says, whichever way it is, whether it's good appearances or bad appearances, it's still just an appearance that arises in the mind, like that we have good conditions or we don't. And once it arises, it has no truly existent nature. It arises and then it's gone. Oops. So now, this is the actual reason that I brought this in, is his explanation of the third kind of patience. The next type of patience is called the patience of having certainty about the Dharma. And it especially has to do with some of the more profound practices of the Dharma. Many of these will be practiced in the, he gave this teaching, I think, right before people went into retreat, one of their retreats. Many of these will be practiced in the 3-year retreats, such as the 6 yogas of Naropa and various Yidam deity practices. And, you know, for those of us, those of you who have traveled the Dharma path program to like the levels of, say, the 4 deities practice and the Milarepa practice, those are very profound practices and one can get discouraged because they're hard. So he says, there are many profound means that you will be introduced to as you advance in Dharma practice. And with some of them, you may think, oh, this is way too much for me. I can't do this. This is too profound. I'll never understand or realize it. I'll never get any results. But that kind of attitude itself is an obstacle because yes, you can do it. You have the karma to be practicing the Dharma. That's why you are here. That's why you're involved in the Dharma. If you didn't have the potential, the Dharma path would not have attracted you in the first place. And it's just a matter of your own resolve. This is his main point, the strength of your own resolve. So if thoughts like I can't do it arise, you should just think, I will do it. I must do it. The patience of having certainty about the Dharma includes having fearless intellectual receptivity. I really like that phrase, fearless intellectual receptivity towards such things as we just described, the advanced practices, emptiness, and so forth. As the profound, skillful means of the Vajrayana and also the vast scope of the deeds of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So that means, again, that you may hear about great practitioners such as Milarepa or the great Bodhisattvas and the activities of the Buddhas and think they can do those sorts of things, but I will never be able to. But you shouldn't think in that way because you should be very decisive in your certainty that you do have Buddha nature. And so you do have the capacity and the potential to accomplish everything, to accomplish complete liberation. And you should remember the words of Milarepa, who said that it was because I was afraid of dying that I went to the mountains into retreat. That's the quote. It was because I was afraid of dying that I went to the mountains and to retreat. And then Lama Noro Rinpoche explaining, it started out with just that simple fear that we all have of dying. And then Milarepa said, because I then went to the mountains and to retreat and I meditated on the uncertainty of the time of death, then with that as a motivation, through that as the intent, I have now achieved the state of deathlessness and I have no fear of death because I have achieved a state beyond death. Anybody who's been reading Mingyur Rinpoche's book, In Love with the World, what is that the name of it? In Love with the World? This is what he addresses. This is the exact thing that he addresses, is working with death in our lives, overcoming our fear of dying by understanding that we're dying all the time, for example. So I highly recommend that book to anybody who's not reading it yet, In Love with the World. So back to Rinpoche, it's very important to have a really strong heart and a very strong determination to practice the Dharma and to have the resolve that I absolutely will practice so I don't need to fear death. I'm going to practice so that I can become free of fear of death, and I'm going to do my best to follow the great examples of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And to always strengthen your determination is really the key to success in Dharma practice. As the Buddha said, I have pointed out the path to liberation. Now it's up to you whether you follow it or not. And that's completely true. It's all going to be revealed to you in the Dharma. All the methods are at your disposal. It depends on you whether you are determined to put these methods into practice. So you should make that determination and strengthen your own resolve. So this is the third kind of patience, is not being discouraged by anything. And what we'd seen before was the idea of not being discouraged by concepts that are alien to us and that seem unfathomable, like emptiness and the three kayas and so forth. But he's saying, you know, with regard to all Dharma practice, we should just always be confident that we have what it takes. We can get there. We can understand emptiness. We can understand the three kayas. We can accomplish awakening. Like never become daunted and think that you can't do it. So his last paragraph. And further, you should also have, again, fearless intellectual receptivity towards the profound meaning of emptiness and the freedom from conceptual extremes, whatever the terms are that describe the nature of mind. So don't be daunted by the fact that you don't feel you've recognized the nature of mind or you don't understand emptiness yet. He said you should have that same kind of determination and resolve with regard to those things. So these types of patience, all three, are really important in practicing the Dharma because there will always be challenges and hardships that you undergo in practicing the Dharma. And if you have patience while undergoing them, you're going to make great progress. So we have it from Lama Noro Rinpoche. Our progress is guaranteed if we just continue the path and don't get discouraged. So we have a couple of minutes left. Anybody, and that's it, that's what I got. So anybody have any comments, questions, insights, experiences to share? If not, we could take, oh yes, here comes Joanne. Yes, Joanne.
Is it being realistic in the fact that, in the midst of anger, and you're getting barraged with someone's negative emotion, that you in some way can do some kind of mental tonglen in response?
Absolutely. Excellent tool. Yeah, excellent response. That anything that helps you, as Pema Chidren says, de-escalate the situation. So when you do tonglen, you're taking your mind off blaming the other person or getting, you know, having your button pushed, and you're turning your attention to their suffering, for example. You can do tonglen for your own suffering. You're taking yourself out, counting to 10, same effect, only not a profound method, just an ordinary method. Counting to 10 takes you out of the reaction to anything that disengages you even a little bit, excuse me, from being caught up in the emotion. Tonglen would be probably the best possible response.
Can I also feel that I'm ameliorating the negative karma that's being generated in the emotion of that?
Absolutely. That's that confidence, I think. I mean, on the one hand, we recognize that we may not be having an actual physical effect on things, but we could think that we are. You know, we could have that positive attitude. And I think, you know, I think what has the effect, it may or may not come from the Tonglen itself, but it comes from your own de-escalation, your own disengagement from your emotional reaction. That brings down the other person's emotion too. Maybe not like immediately, but if you're not reacting, whatever it is that's preventing you from actually reacting and lashing out, that has an effect on them. It helps them manage their own emotion.
All right.
Okay, thank you, Joanne. Thank you for that question and that thought. Anybody else have anything? Any other suggestions? Okay, well, now we're past 3:30, so we will do our dedication. Oops, wrong folder. It's a lot of paperwork involved in this enterprise. All right, so now we have completed 3 of the 6 paramitas, the action part of action bodhicitta, the way to actually travel the path, generosity, the 3 kinds of generosity, 3 kinds of ethical conduct or skillful action, and the 3 kinds of patience. That is a lot of tools to work with. And before we take our summer break, we will complete the next 2. We'll have perseverance under our belt and also meditation. So we have a lot to work with for the rest of our lives. So let's bring our minds to rest again, to whatever extent they're not already at rest. Open awareness, all senses completely wide open. Following your breath if that's helpful, whatever sort of brings you down to earth and into the present moment. And within that state, we will dedicate the merit. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the 2 sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate, the blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast sangha. This dedication, please fulfill. Okay, everybody is unmuted.
Thank you so much, Lama. That was great.
Thank you all for being here and for practicing generosity, ethical conduct, and patience. So we'll see you next week. Lama Jinsang will be back with us, and she will lead us through joyful perseverance.
Thank you.
Everybody, have a good week.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You may be. Have a good week.